Hi, thank you. I'm Desmond. I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be here tonight. This is a terrific way to start off the new year as far as I'm concerned. I can't think of another place I'd like to be in the whole world. As a matter of fact, I came in here just, I guess, really to speak tonight because I arrived in Los Angeles a week ago Sunday and had planned to have a lot of business meetings today, and they all fell through. But as a result of meeting with Clancy last week and the Midnight Mission, I had a commitment to be here to share with you my experience, strength, and hope about a subject that all of us collectively know an awful lot about. And it's a tribute to you that you have such a man as Clancy leading you, having founded the group so many years ago, and there's so much powerful sobriety here. I was talking to some of the celebrants tonight. I mean, it's, you know, you rattle off 24 years and 22 years and 19 years. I'm almost 17 years, and I feel like an infant. And at the same time, all of us working together, in my experience, is what's kept me sober. I couldn't get sober by myself. I tried that for many, many years. I thought I was more powerful than alcohol. I didn't understand the first step. When I walked into my first meeting, it was actually 18 years ago when I walked into my first meeting, so you know I had a birth by fire during that first year. And I looked up at the window shade that had the 12 steps written on it, and I read the window shade through, and I said, "Got it." And I really meant that, because I thought if I understood something, I had it. I figured my mental power was so great that it would affect my actions. I heard Jane speak about trying to think herself into right action. Well, I thought that's the way life worked. I was smart enough to have one reservation about that, though, when I saw those 12 steps. I said, "Got it." And then I looked again and I said, "Well, that first one's a little tough. But the rest of them I think I can handle." And so that's what I proceeded to do for the first year. I proceeded to handle the rest of them. I used to go to meetings, and people used to write down the things I was saying. It was so witty. It was so terrific. It was sort of the point. It was so really on target. And they stayed sober, but I kept getting drunk. And I couldn't figure out why that happened until I heard the first man who read the How It Works section. I mean, I'm always impressed by that section because it talks about the need to be totally honest. And after my third or fourth slip, I remember I was sitting on a beach, and one of the people who had a lot of sobriety, whom I respected an awful lot, said to me, "Desmond, the reason you can't get sober is because you're dishonest." And you know, I was shattered by that. I mean, here I was, you know, a stellar guy, doing my damnedest to be really honest, and this SOB was labeling me somebody who was dishonest. I was really hurt. I was shattered by that. And I was, you know, off the sauce for at least 8 hours at that particular time. And I heard the first reader, whose name I can't remember, talk about that gift of honesty that began to come to me as a result of this program. It began to come to me as a result of practicing some of these principles of admitting, first of all, not the way I used to walk into a meeting. I remember walking into a meeting. Clancy spoke in a meeting in New York called the Midtown Group, which isn't as quite as large as this, but it's pretty large, a few months back. And I remember when that group started. We used to have 10 people, and we used to meet in a coat room, like your ante room here, when it started. And I used to walk into there, and I used to say, "I'm Desmond, and I got this little problem with alcohol. I'm not an alcoholic, but I've got this problem that I can't seem to drink right, and I'm not willing to admit I'm an alcoholic." So everybody just kind of, you know, looked, and some rolled their eyes, and some laughed, but they all let me stay around. They let me hang around. And I kept coming back that way, despite the fact that I'd go out, and people would come in and say to me, "Gee, Desmond, glad to see you back. Gee, it's really nice that you made it back." And then one guy said, I knew you were going to come back. And I didn't like that so much because I didn't like people predicting what I was going to do. That didn't make me very happy because I was really a free spirit. And then somebody else had the gall to say to me, you know, Des, it's great to have you back, and you did it for me. How was it? And I mean, you know how you feel when you're coming back from one of those things, right? I didn't feel too good, and I didn't feel too good about that person. But, you know, that was honesty in there. Because they were looking at me eyeball to eyeball, and they said, look it, the reality is you can't drink. You can't drink anymore. You can't think yourself into not drinking. What you've got to do is hang around with us, and we'll show you how to act yourself into not drinking. And so I'd go out again and kind of wander back, and I'd find out that I couldn't drink. I mean, I started doing things like I hadn't done before. I'd wind up rolling a car off the highway, being stopped by cops, and the cops were going to put me in jail, except that I knew some people they happened to know. So instead of putting me in jail, they drove me back to my house. But I really got scared, because I knew deep inside of me that where I was going was to the Bowery in Manhattan. And I know what happens down there. I mean, I saw those guys coming off the street and wiping the windshields of your car and looking to panhandle 25 cents. And I saw the ragged shoes, because I remember one time when I was drinking. I used to get up in the morning, salute my eyes because they were red, white, and blue. The Visine wasn't around, so I used to use murine. But murine didn't get the red out at all. It didn't work at all. And as a matter of fact, one time I was using murine all day because I just was trying to get the red out. And I went to a disco that night. And you know, murine has this quality that it attracts light. So I had translucent eyes. I mean, my eyes sparkled all evening in the disco. But one time I'd gone through my usual morning routine of saluting myself in the mirror. And then I used to walk down to my office. And on the way down to my office, so I wouldn't be without booze, I'd stop in a few liquor stores. And I'd walk into a liquor store, very nonchalant, because I didn't want the liquor store owner at 8:30 in the morning when I opened the store to think I was an alcoholic. So I would say to him, do you have these tiny bottles of alcohol? Now, I knew damn well they were called miniatures, but I thought if I said to him, do you have these tiny bottles of alcohol, he would figure I was some kind of tiny bottle collector. And what I had was this fabulous wood-paneled living room with tiny bottles of alcohol from all over the world that I had collected assiduously day by day with my red, white, and blue eyes and my jagged jowls and my look as if death had just left me. So that was the way I would start my day, because I had gone out to lunch one time and I was sitting with my boss and we were chatting. And I ordered a glass of water, and I drank the glass of water down with no problem. I ordered my vodka martini, because I no longer drank gin, because everybody became very argumentative when I drank gin. So the vodka was certainly something that I could deal with. So what happened was, when the vodka martini arrived, I began to shake. I just tightened. My whole body began to tighten up. Now, talk about dishonesty. I mean, today, if I feel a pain somewhere, I try to figure out the reason. I didn't try to figure out the reason then. All that was going on with me was, how do I get this drink down? And of course, my frustration, my anxiety reached higher and higher pitches, because at that point, I couldn't pick up a sandwich. I couldn't have a bowl of soup. I couldn't pick up any water. I couldn't pick up my vodka martini. And what I needed to spend the rest of the meal in some kind of peace was that vodka martini. I didn't think of using a straw. I've heard of people use straws. I didn't think of that. I couldn't very well just go down like that, which is what I wanted to do because I was sitting with these two guys. So I left the table and I walked to the front of the restaurant. And I looked around and they could still see me. So that was out. I left the restaurant, dashed across the street, all the while knowing they were talking about me, concerned about me, wondering where I was going, ran to a bar next door across the street, plunked down my money, and the bar was like 10 deep. It was 42nd Street and Lexington Avenue in New York City. And plunked 10 bucks down in the bar, got a vodka martini, drank it like this. It probably took 90 seconds, the whole episode. My anxiety was getting higher and higher and higher, but I knew if I got that booze in me, I could drink the second one. Charged back across the street, sat down, and by this time the booze had taken effect. Picked up the glass of booze, and I drank it down. And then when they asked me if I wanted a second drink, I said no. I thought that was pretty big of me. So so those were the kind of things that used to happen with my drinking. And those were the kind of dishonest things that I used to do when I was drinking. I was thinking about, there were so many things I wanted to share with you tonight, and I'll probably won't get a chance to share them all, but that's okay because you'll pick up bits and pieces, and I'll pick up bits and pieces from you. I already feel better just being here, as a matter of fact. There's so much positive energy in this room that has carried me from place to place. I was talking to Maurice before the meeting, or George, and saying I didn't think I had spoken out here on the West Coast before, but I did. I spoke at Laguna Beach 2 years ago. I was the warm-up for Doretha at that time. And but so much positive energy has carried me from place to place in this program. I mean, I've spoken in New York. I've spoken in a lot of major cities around this country. I spoke in London. I've spoken in Amsterdam. I've spoken in Geneva. Just kind of wandering into meetings. And the positive power of this program has taken me and changed my life. I mean, that's a real substantial change. We talk about the spiritual awakening in the 12th step. And the 12 and 12 defines that pretty clearly as a different state of consciousness. And I've got to be serious about this, that my consciousness has changed dramatically. Not because I wanted it to, but because I had no choice. When I used to come to the program and then say all those wonderful things and then go out and get drunk again, I finally realized at one point that I could not drink. And that was a petrifying experience to me. Because the booze didn't work anymore. I mean, I wasn't getting that high. You know, the crackle of the martini didn't work anymore. It wasn't there anymore for me. But I had to drink because I was afraid not to drink. Because I had this vision in my mind that it was a merry-go-round going faster and faster. And if I stopped drinking, I was going to fall off and like an alabaster statue, fall to pieces. And I wanted not to drink. And I couldn't on my own not drink. So I kept coming back to these meetings and took the guff of people who told me that I went out there and did it for them. Did those kind of things. And gradually, the program took me. So it was just by showing up at these meetings that day by day, gifts came to me. I mean, the gift of honesty, the gift of accepting my powerlessness over this 2 ounce or 1 ounce demon that is the death of us all. Slowly but surely, I began to get some momentum and some power. I began to see clearly. I began to get the honesty. I did the things it said in the steps, petrified as I was, doing them all wrong. I mean, I did my fourth step by taking these 3x5 cards out and wrote down on a 3x5 card everything I could think of that I did wrong. And I went like this, like that. And then I put them away because I didn't want to look at them again. I mean, talk about fearless. Talk about in-depth moral inventory. I mean, this was about as fearful and as superficial as you could get. But I did it. So the action began to give way to the right thinking. The action began to give way to the gift of honesty. So my walking into the room, taking these little tiny steps, full of fear, full of not understanding, began to pay off. So that over time, over these 16 years and 9 months, different things of that spiritual awakening began to be a part of me, began to be a part of Desmond. And I've had incredible experiences in this program. I remember once I was going over to Monte Carlo on business. And I went up in Monte Carlo and I was horrible. I mean, I felt horrible. I had all the money I wanted. I had a beautiful hotel room looking over the Mediterranean. And I was miserable. I was angry, and I was hungry, and I was lonely, and I was tired, and all those things. So I went to sleep. And I woke up, and I was worse. So I picked up the phone in the hotel, and I asked somebody to find me an AA meeting. I asked the operator, because they were speaking French, and I didn't know much French. They couldn't find one in Monte Carlo. So I picked up the phone, and I called New York, the GSO office in New York. And I got a woman on the phone You know what she said to me? Oh, yeah, Desmond, I know exactly where you are. I've been there many times. What I want you to do is I want you to call Sophia in Cannes, and I want you to call somebody else in Nice, and you just talk to them for a while, and you'll feel much better. So I got their numbers. I talked to them in my broken French, and they spoke to me in their French and English or whatever it was. Went to a meeting the following night, and it made the difference. Well, I went back some years later to the same place, but this time I was smarter because I'd been around a little longer. So what I did was I called up one of those people that I had met on the first trip through. They met me at the airport. We had lunch together, and they said to me, Desmond, here's a meeting you can go to in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ré. It's right on the harbor. It's 20 minutes from here. The meeting starts in a half hour. You can make it easy. Well, P.S., I got lost. I mean, I wound up on top of the mountains and driving one way in a wrong way, and the French coming out and screaming and laughing and talking to me in French. I didn't know what they were saying. They didn't know what I was saying. They were all very happy. But I couldn't find the meeting. So I finally find this city, and I wander into it about an hour after I thought the meeting was over, and because I had gotten really lost. And I parked the car, and I began looking for it. Well, I couldn't find the meeting. I wandered up steps, down hills, everything else. Couldn't find the meeting. And I was about to leave to go back to where I was staying, or to go to where I was staying. And I wandered up a set of stairs, and I saw a big sign. Now, talking about reading signs. So a big sign that said AA. And there was an arrow pointing to a door. So I walked up the stairs, and I heard voices. I said, oh, great. I got here. The meeting isn't over yet. I'll get to a meeting. Well, I got up there, and people were playing cards. So it was an old age group of people, and they were probably a parish or something, and they were playing cards. I said, well, the meeting must have been here, but I missed it. So I went down again and began to go up the stairs again. I see another sign, and this sign now is very definitely pointing to a door. Well, there's a window next to the door, so being really bright, I figured, well, let me just see. I mean, I'd only come 3,000, whatever the number is, 6,000 miles to get to this city to find this meeting. But I wasn't going to open the door. I was just going to check the windows out to see if anybody was in there. So I checked the windows out, and there was nobody in there. I mean, it was dark. And so I said, there must have been a meeting there, but I guess I missed it. So I began to walk up the steps. And it was as if somebody grabbed me by the back of my collar and pulled me back down and said, well, look it. You know, why don't you just, you know, knock on the door? I mean, maybe. You know there's nobody in there, but maybe the arrow's pointing there. Try it. So I did. Well, the door opens, and you know what happened. There were 10 people holding big books, sitting there. This beautiful redheaded woman looks up at me from the table, and she says, Desmond? I said, yeah. She said, we've been waiting for you. And so I walked in, and they translated what I said into French, and they translated what they said into English. And it was the beginning of a fabulous change in my life. These changes kept coming and coming and coming. The change that I've gone through this past year has been remarkable. You know, we start out, or I started out, in AA, knowing that I could stay sober on my own. And really just trying to pick up some pointers and auditing this course here. And found out it didn't work that way. I couldn't stay sober on my own. So I found out that the steps were written with a real purpose. That we together could do something that I couldn't do by myself. And so I recovered with lots of people. I recovered with you. Part of my recovery story is the exchange we're having here this evening. I don't have to go anywhere else to recover. I get healed of everything that I need to be healed of right here this evening with you because of the strength and the power. So the unity that we experience in those traditions that Karen read tonight keeps us together. I didn't understand that. I mean, I was a solo flyer. I didn't understand that. Didn't appreciate that. Wanted to do it on my own. Wanted to do it different. Wanted to write my own script for AA. Well, the script's been written for me. It's really down there in the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And then change kept coming in, change after change after change. I used to travel a lot, and I still do a bit. And I used to be very lonely when I traveled. But somewhere along the line, I discovered that what I needed to do for me was I needed to become not so much somebody weighing, you know, do I dare, is it on the one hand, on the other hand, can I do this, analyzing, killing myself with analyzing. I had to start acting. I had to start doing things intuitively. I didn't know how to do that. I'd never learned that. I figured you did everything with your mind. Well, I figured and talked to somebody, and I said, well, what I need to do is I need to meditate. Maybe if I meditate, I will get connected with this higher power. I didn't want any higher power when I came in. You know, I was thinking tonight that I started having a spiritual awakening when I was 10 years old. I think that's true. Because at 10 years old, I decided I was going to join a religious order, the same order that makes the wine out here in the Napa Valley, Christian Brothers. So I joined the order, did a lot of spiritual things and spiritual reading and all those kinds of things. And when I went out teaching and began to drink, I consistently, after about 5 years of drinking, 6 years of drinking, began to get drunk. Couldn't stop it, couldn't explain it, didn't know why. From having that great capacity we've all talked about. So that spiritual awakening that I had experienced, which drove me, which propelled me, which moved me towards the Christian Brothers when I was 10 years old and 11 and 12 and finally went away when I was 13, it began then, and then got interrupted by the booze. Because there's no way to be spiritually connected when I was comatose. There's no way to be spiritually connected when I was falling through a glass coffee table at a dinner party, or losing my car and having to get a cab driver to take me around Manhattan up and down the streets to find my car. You couldn't be spiritual because there's too much other stuff going on in there. And all that stuff separated me from that power greater than myself. So when I walked in the rooms, I didn't want that power because I was a self-made alcoholic. And a self-made alcoholic knows exactly how to do everything and is responsible for everything in their lives and does need that power. But somewhere along the line, the idea of meditating crept in. And so it came into my life. And I began to meditate every morning, just set aside 60 seconds, and it became 90, and then it became 180 seconds, and then it became 3 minutes, then it became 20 minutes, and then I scrapped it for a while, and I came back, and maybe it's 5 minutes a day. Or maybe it's just running to a meeting and flipping my head back in a cab and putting myself in the presence of my higher power. So I come back refreshed, I come back powerful and strong from all the myriad of things I've been doing in the course of a day. But part of that spiritual awakening was out here in California. I woke up in a hotel room in Monterey, and I used to get this awful feeling in the morning when I woke up because I was alone. And this morning, although there was nobody else in the room with me, no other human being, I knew I wasn't alone that particular morning. Because I felt the presence of that power that I had turned my back on, whose consciousness I didn't want to be connected to. I felt that presence. And then again, I was in a meeting up in Toronto, Canada, and I was sitting at the meeting, and I was doing what I've heard a lot of alcoholics do. I was sitting there at the meeting saying to myself, what a stupid meeting this is. I mean, these people are really dumb. I mean, the stupid things they're saying. And look at this guy. I mean, his tie is not straight, and his suit doesn't look right, and his belt is all crumpled, his trousers all crumpled, and what a stupid meeting. And I said to myself, well, why don't you just put yourself in the presence of your higher power, whom I call God? I didn't want to do that because I thought that if I did that, I was copping out on you, that I was going to go off into some kind of ivory tower and would be unable to connect with you. Well, the opposite is true. What happened was I did put myself in the presence of God. I began to see clearly. I saw that I was playing some kind of voyeur, that these people had invited me up there to be part of the meeting, that if I was bored, and I thought they were stupid because I was bored and I was stupid and I was the person that wasn't doing anything with this meeting. So what could I do to make a difference in this meeting? So that's what I began to do. I began to walk in to the meeting and take a part and make a difference. And that was a significant turning point also. That awareness in Monterey, that awareness that this higher power could connect with me And I could connect with that higher power even as I'm talking to you and even as you're listening to me. That rather than take me away from you, it makes me more a part of you and you more a part of me. So we understand each other very, very quickly. That the shorthand way we have of communicating and the unwritten agenda. You know, the unwritten agenda here is the agenda of the joy of living in that 12th step. Because I didn't see any people weeping when they walked in here. I mean, it seems to me this is a pretty up group, that people love to be here, and that's what it's about. It's the joy of living and taking that presence of a higher power into the third area, the third legacy that we talk about in terms of service. Clancy asked me the other day when I was at the midnight, at the mission, how does it feel to be a trustee of AA? It feels fabulous to be a trustee of AA. And it feels fabulous to be a trustee of AA because I feel in a very real way that I can assist in maintaining the tradition that was set up by Bill and Bob. The thing that started before I was born, that I had nothing to do with, that saved my life. I have a way that I can share that now and in the service area can make a difference for a number of years. So I'd been in service for 4 years, and then people asked me if I would be a trustee last April at the conference, and I said I'd be honored to be a trustee. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing when you think about it, because it says in the big book that our stories are nothing about human brilliance. What they're about is human degradation. And so here I am, a trustee among people who have been degraded. And so maybe I'm the most degraded of all is one way of looking at it, isn't it? But then it moves on beyond that, and it says, this human degradation has been transformed by the catalytic action of the grace of God as expressed in the living program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the testimony that I can give to you tonight. That's the testimony of Jane and Don, Karen, everybody that's been here, people who are going to take a cake this evening, that this program works, the simple little slogans, the dumb things that we were asked to do, that this is where it's at. You know, AA is a mission of commandos. I remember I used to go down to the men's shelter on the Bowery in New York when I used to feel sorry for myself. You know, I got the dose of the poor me's and things weren't going right for me. And I'd hear a Puerto Rican guy, a heavy Puerto Rican guy, look around, all these glassy-eyed drunks walking in off the Bowery, you know, with blood on their forehead and the raggedy pants. The same guys that I used to walk into liquor stores after. Me with my white shirt and tie. They with their raggedy pants and newspapers on their feet. They would order their bottle of Thunderbird and I'd order my tiny bottles of vodka. And I knew the only difference between myself and those guys was the clothes they were wearing, because I knew damn well I was an alcoholic. But the men's shelter, this guy would say, in this business, there's no winners. There's only survivors. It's atomic warfare. We're the survivors. We've survived day by day, until today, a disease that is aimed at killing me. And it's through the spiritual power of us all here tonight, the spiritual power of me as expressed or as expressing the power of the God of my understanding to you, and the thing that we do to that that makes it much more powerful than me or you or us collectively, that has made the difference.